Hey, it's Matt. Today's show is pre-recorded from a live event last Thursday evening in Evansville. It's part of a series we're doing called Issues and Ales. The topic was healthcare, and the questions came from you via our Indiana 2020 two-way texting tool. If you'd like to participate in discussions like this, you can sign up by simply texting elections to 73224. And a quick note, this show was made through a collaboration between SideFX Public Media and America Amplified, which is a national initiative designed to produce innovative reporting by listening to community concerns. SideFX Public Media and Indiana Public Broadcasting are part of that project.
This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser, and we're at Damsel Brew Pub in Evansville. And I want to welcome our partners from WNIN and thank them for having us, and especially the listeners of WNIN who took the time to come out and listen to a conversation about healthcare on a school night. And so, yeah, that's what we're talking about today. How much does it cost? How can we find that out before we undergo certain procedures? And, you know, from what we've heard from listeners, they're tired of gotchas in healthcare. There have been some legislative proposals to fix it. And also just understanding insurance is what people want to know. Speaking for myself, a healthy person in my mid-30s, I just pick the option that they tell me to do and go with it. And I'll be honest, sometimes it feels like I'm just setting my money on fire. Also, people want to know how the healthcare companies use that money. And I hope that our panel can help us with all of that tonight. I want to welcome Claudia Eisenman, President and CEO of Gibson General Hospital, Mark Fairchild, Policy Director at Covering Kids and Families, and Amber Williams, Lead Healthcare Navigator at Covering Kids and Families of TRICAP. Welcome to all of you. All right, we're going to start with some of the questions and comments that we pulled from our texting service, Indiana 2022 Way. And so as far as healthcare goes, we have one listener that wants to know about transparency and costs and billing. They say billing is very confusing and it's hard to know what things cost. Many times the same visitor procedure is billed differently. Mark, do you want to take that one?
Right. And then that's one of the most common issues that we're hearing right now is that idea of surprise billing or non-transparent billing, that the consumer really doesn't know until something shows up in their mailbox how expensive a procedure is going to be. And there's so many factors that play into that. But the key word that we're seeing right now is transparency. Even if I'm still going to get that bill, I wanted to know that bill was coming and how to deal with it and be prepared for it ahead of time or make different choices if that bill was something I wasn't going to be able to afford. A lot of work going on there actually federally. They're working on bill packages to try to address how can we make sure that at least a reasonable estimate is put out to consumers. And we have a couple of bills at the Indiana State House right now that some are talking about giving an estimate ahead of time. Others are saying it's going to be hard to estimate the precise cost of care because once you get to the hospital, there's a lot of other things they can find out. As they get in there and explore and see other things, as they see what kind of anesthesia you're going to need. But can we at least maybe collect a history of claims? And that's another thing they're looking at. It's called an all-payer claims database, which sounds like another cumbersome term to add to the mix, but would be a place where claims are put where the public can look at them and say, okay, this hospital, this procedure cost this much these last five times it was done. So you at least have some ability to look at that and look across systems in that way and be a little bit more informed.
I want to go to another question about less populated areas. This listener says, when I first moved to this county, and I don't know what county they're talking about, but maybe it's a rural county, not all the doctors were affiliated with the only local hospital, which they put in parentheses as a for-profit hospital. Now all of those doctors are affiliated with that hospital, and the charges went up. They say the idea that people can shop around and compare prices isn't practical in a rural area like that. Claudia, I don't know. Could you respond to that?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. So there are a lot of things going on in healthcare right now that have made it really difficult for physicians to remain independent, particularly in rural marketplaces. And increasingly, because of the onerous burden of the regulatory requirements, something we call meaningful use, which really speaks to the electronic health record and the requirements around that, all these things that physicians have to comply with in the same way, but a little bit differently than hospitals have to comply, it's just become unaffordable for them to run their practices as businesses services in the way that they used to be able to. So in order to stay in some of these communities, what's happened is hospitals have gotten into the business of employing doctors. In the community that you're talking about, it sounds like it is a one-hospital community, which is not unusual in rural health care.
Is that your hospital? Would you say that that's the same situation?
We are in a rural community. Yes, we are. And I can tell you the cost to keep that hospital moving forward is exceptional. Just for example, one of the things that we've done last year, in addition to trying to recruit other physicians, but we've brought all of our physicians onto our electronic health record. We've gone enterprise-wide with that, and that's a federal requirement under the Affordable Care Act that we needed to do. But we spent $4.3 million on that. So, it's just, there are many, many costs, I think, in healthcare that people just don't understand. And if I didn't work in healthcare, I wouldn't understand them either. But, the reality is when you have physicians that need to be in communities in order to provide access points for people, because let's face it, you can't get your screenings done, you can't have wellness services done, you can't have early detection of disease done if you have no physicians in the community to write those orders. So in that case, they've got to join those health systems in order to be maintained in those communities to try to raise the health standard there and the wellness standard. Now, each and every individual hospital charges whatever they charge. In the case of a for-profit hospital, and I want to just say this now, even though I work in not-for-profit healthcare, not every for-profit hospital is bad. But, they've got to make a profit margin for a host of reasons, none the least of which is they have stockholders that are going to expect some kind of return on the investment that they have. So we don't have standardized pricing in healthcare. So in the case of that particular hospital, they changed the prices according to whatever was determined to be most fair in that marketplace by their owner, by whoever the company's owner is.
Do you prefer the nonprofit world?
There are differences. I worked for probably half of my career in for-profit healthcare and specialty hospitals and so forth. I think one of the things that's a misnomer when you compare not-for-profit healthcare and for-profit healthcare is we are all trying to create some sort of margin. It's just different what you do with that margin that you generate if you're in a not-for-profit setting. So in our not-for-profit hospital, what we do with any kind of return that we have is we reinvest it back in technology and that sort of thing. So for example, the $4.3 million for our electronic health record, that was one investment. Another thing that we just did is we just put a new MRI in. That was $1.1 million for the MRI. And you increasingly see that not-for-profit hospitals are highly engaged in what the needs are in their community and how to reinvest to support those needs, because we don't have to return something back to the stockholders. So, it's not that one is bad and one is good. It's just there's different philosophies and different points of view about how we approach the work of healthcare in the community.
But from a leadership perspective, from where you sit, does it seem like nonprofit, there might be more freedom, less people to answer to?
I think, in my case, I report to a local board, and so I have a group of individuals who is responsible for setting strategy and that I report to in terms of my execution on that strategies on the job. I think that the difference is really in the for-profit system as opposed to the not-for-profit systems. Oftentimes, you have more local autonomy and local control in the not-for-profit systems. I like that better because I like to engage with the community. I think my number one job in what I do is actually to engage with the community in a meaningful way so that we can get people to elevate their own health standards. I mean, if we do that, then we're going to be talking very differently about cost anyway. For example, you talked about, well, gee whiz, you're in your mid-30s and you're healthy and I'm spending all this money. I mean, who's getting this stuff, right? Well, you're in a risk pool. So you're right, you're not using it. But somebody else that's in that same risk pool with you that isn't as healthy, Maybe they have some various health disparities because of their social situation, and there are genuine social determinants of health in this country, as well as maybe individual choices that haven't been the best along the way. If you're in a community hospital setting and you're in a not-for-profit where we actually put great effort and resources into that, then we can have that conversation and start moving the needle in that area. So for me, it's a good fit to be in the not-for-profits.
We have another question from a listener. Mark, I think I'm going to give this one to you. This listener says, I get my insurance from the marketplace, and it went up $129 a month. Why does it go up every year, even though the plan hasn't changed?
Right, and obviously I can't speak to that specific listener's case, but there's a lot of things that impact the marketplace. And I think it's a misnomer that we think it's some kind of static thing that's controlled by a lot of government regulation and everything else, so it shouldn't move. But it's actually just as fluid as any other insurance market when you're in that. So a lot of things have impacted that in the last few years. There's been a ton of political uncertainty. And that political uncertainty for insurance companies meant we didn't know if the subsidies they're used to getting or the support they get from the government was going to come through. So they increased the cost of their premiums to say, hey, we can't actually lose money here. And some of that actually came back. Last year, it's something that those companies aren't allowed to have a ratio of greater than 80 to 20%, 80% spent on client care, and then 20% for profit, overhead, and other expenses there. So there's only a certain amount of profit they actually are allowed to take. And with some groups, it's actually even narrower. It's 85 to 15%. And last year, we actually saw the largest amount in, really since the inception of the Affordable Care Act, of refunds that had to go back to consumers because they guessed wrong on the numbers because of all the uncertainty in the air. So that's just one key variable. There's other things. If somebody hits against what's called the age rating, if you're between the age of 50 to 64, you can be charged up to three times as much versus somebody who's younger and assumed to be healthier, not always the case. But that's one of the few areas of the Affordable Care Act that's still open that they can charge more. So if you're looking for a system that took out a lot of your ability to make a profit or to keep your business, in the case of a nonprofit insurance company, just keep your business soluble, you have to use those pockets where you are able to charge a little bit more. So it could be a lot of things with that specific individual, and their income could have flowed up or down, and their subsidy would have changed. But it's definitely something that we've seen a lot of. The positive note is last year was probably the most stable year we've seen in the marketplace. For this year's plan selections, Indiana stayed pretty flat, 3 to 5% different from the year before, which is about the flattest we've seen. And nationwide, it was even a tighter margin than that. So we're seeing some stability. And I would count a lot of that towards what's going on politically, how they've kind of backed away and said, okay, let's see what the market does now on its own.
We'll be back next with more of our pre-taped discussion on healthcare from Damsel Brew Pub in Evansville. I'm Matt Pelser. That's 90 seconds away. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to a pre-recorded live event which took place last Thursday evening in Evansville at Damsel Brew Pub, part of an Indiana Public Broadcasting event series called Issues and Ales. The topic was healthcare coverage.
And I don't want to get too much into politics, but when you're talking about healthcare these days, it's going to happen. And with all of, with a lot, not all of the Democratic candidates for president talking about things like single-payer healthcare, where I go for that opinion is a person who works in healthcare. And I have a dear friend out in the Pacific Northwest who's an ER physician, and he's going to have a hard time voting for someone who's pushing for single payer. You don't have to show your stripes too much here. Now, don't worry. But I guess from a healthcare provider or navigator perspective, how does that seem like it might work, or would it?
Yeah, and you're right. It's more complex than that. So
sure.
Part of me, and obviously I politics is a big part of what I'm involved in. I always like to say I work in policy, but politics keeps sucking me in. But we hear a lot of that. We hear that mantra of Medicare for all. And we see that comparison to other countries that maybe have enacted that in the past and what have happened with that, pros and cons. A key thing to really look at is that the U.S. market was built on private system on top of private system on top of private system. A lot of other countries started towards something socialized. Mm. They maybe didn't have a healthcare system, and they introduced it at a socialized level. So regardless of if it would work or if it would not, we have a huge transformation process that would have to happen along the way that could be difficult. It could be very hard for our providers that, as was already mentioned, are already struggling in a lot of ways, the hospital systems, finding a rate that actually lets them keep their doors open, because I think a lot of them be scared to death right now. If you were to look at Medicaid rates, I don't know a single system or provider that can stay open based on just those rates alone. So it's more about what kind of system transformation, whether it was something like Medicare for All or whether it was shoring up the gaps in communication and transparency in our private system. We've got a lot of work ahead of us either way.
Mm. And if I could just add to your point about this subject, because it is really, really complicated. Take Medicaid, for example. So Medicaid is set up as a state insurance program for people that are economically disadvantaged in some way. But hospitals get 23 cents on the dollar of cost, not billed charges, cost. So that means we eat the rest of that. Medicare, we get 87 cents on the dollar for every Medicare patient of cost. So you can see right away that there would be a tremendous level of apprehension on the part of providers like me when we're talking about moving to these government payment systems. You know, when we're already serving these populations and losing money on every single one, what does that portend in terms of a single payer system? So again, it's very complicated. This is not something that can be unwound and decided just because it's popular in a political campaign.
Let's move on to another question. This is a big one. And I've heard this before about the good old days. Were they really the good old days? Here we go. For many of us who've been engaging with the American healthcare system since the 70s and 80s, there's always the question of how costs have risen so astronomically and why has insurance become so personally expensive yet covers less and less of those astronomical costs. Were they really the good old days, or were fewer people being covered and there were healthier pools? I don't know.
Well, I think, again, you know, there's not just one answer. So the healthcare system sort of tried to change back in the 80s when we went from paying based on billed charges, when the government system went from paying based on billed charges to what's called a prospectively paid system, where they developed what's called diagnostic related groups. And they told hospitals, look, if anybody comes in with this diagnosis, they're in this diagnostic related group, we're going to pay you this amount of money no matter what else is going on with them. No matter if they have other kinds of conditions and regardless of how long they have to be in the hospital. So the idea behind that was we were going to start reducing costs. But that is the point at which we also started reducing payments to hospitals. So, you know, again, you can't take this subject without understanding that there's context. So government payments start kind of going down at that time, but you had an entire system that was built around a different payment methodology. So things began to shift more over to insurance companies and the like. Payments started getting modified across the board. Individuals started picking up a bigger share of insurance through copays and deductibles and this kind of thing. We've seen that continue to escalate in recent years. We have gotten increasingly unhealthy as a country. In Indiana, we don't do so great. You know, we are in the bottom 10 in a lot of key healthcare metrics in the state. And that affects our life expectancy. You know, we don't vaccinate, whether you're a child or adult. We have very low vaccination rates in this state. And I can tell you that leads to disease. We have all kinds of other things going on. We have a very high smoking rate. In fact, one of the comments that I was going to make when we were talking about how the insurance market has surprisingly in Indiana stabilized, our actual smoking rates have gone up, and it's still stabilized. So it really is a striking paradox as it relates to that. Typically, you would see those rates go up. So we have high obesity rates. We have high rates of inactivity. And again, we score in the top 10, it being a really inactive culture in Indiana. So these are really, really important factors, and we've seen them shift what's happened in terms of various health factors and chronic disease across the country. And whenever you change that and you start talking about that in terms of the context of a risk pool, then you're going to see rates go up. It's kind of like what happens with now all of the natural disasters and events that are occurring, whether they're hurricanes and they're earthquakes and so on. What happens? Everybody's insurance goes up, right? It's the same kind of situation. If we don't take control of our own wellness and deal with also some of the social determinants of health and wellness, we're going to continue to see these problems escalate, in my view.
Amber, I'm going to throw this one to you. What does a navigator do?
As a healthcare navigator, it is essentially that we help people navigate through the enrollment process. We work with everything from the Medicaid programs or state programs to the marketplace to federal programs, and we basically become the middleman. We contact the consumer. The consumer contacts us, and we help them get their application going. We help them get verification documents. We help them get their application turned in online, show them information about different policies, plans, basically educate the consumer on everything that is available to them or that they qualify for. A lot of them don't even realize that they qualify for certain things or certain programs, and we educate them on the policies that are available and get them going on that. We help them do the application, like I said, get the verification documents. Even after the if they are approved with the state programs, we help them with redeterminations. We help them with life changes. We help them with the Gateway to Work program. I don't know how familiar people are with the HIP, the state program, and making sure that they are meeting all those requirements. So we help them navigate through that system, because it is a very cumbersome, it is a very overwhelming overwhelming process for people at times. And a lot of them, when you're dealing with, we deal with the majority of, if we're dealing with Medicaid, it is low income that have lots of barriers that to some people, it's not a big deal, but they may not have a car to get to an appointment. They might not have a computer to get their documentations turned in. So we try to help them overcome those barriers and make sure that they get that policy, that plan that really fits them best, and that they're able to overcome some of those barriers.
Could we do a lightning round navigation for me, maybe?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Just to give people an example.
Yeah.
So what would you ask?
How would we
get started on that?
On the initial, well, we do a lot of outreach for, I work for Covering Kids and Families of Indiana under the TRICAP agency. We are in all 92 counties. We're statewide now. And we do a lot of outreach. That's one portion of our job. Half of it is the application process and doing the paperwork part of it. And the other part is outreach. So we go out to health fairs. We go out to coalition meetings. We go out to anything that we can get our foot in the door so people know about us, because that's another issue that we have come across. People don't know that there are navigators out there to help them do this. So I would meet you somewhere by word of mouth, by you would hear about us on advertising or at a community health fair, and you would set up an appointment with me, and you would come in my office. And we also pride ourselves on getting, developing that rapport with the consumer as well, because a lot of people, when you're dealing with the state programs and Medicaid, they're already down on their luck. They think nobody can help them. They're not, you know, they're ashamed or embarrassed to come in and ask for help. So we really try to develop that relationship. We get the paperwork that's necessary. We do an online application for you. And then without going into specifics, if we're doing state programs, then they have time to process it. They have 45 days to process it. And we keep case management, basically, until we get the approval or the denial from the state. And marketplace is the same way. We would educate you, go over the policy and plans that are available for you, And based on your situation, we, as undercovering kids and families, we are non-biased. We do not choose one MCE, which is a managed care entity, or one policy over the other. We don't tell you to choose Anthem or CareSource or MHS. We try to make it so it's the best for you, for your current situation. If your doctors are covered, if your medication's covered, anything like that, so you're educated and you can make that decision on what is going to be the best plan for you. So then we would choose a plan if you're ready to do, you know, on your own time, if you're ready to do it that day, if you're not ready to do it that day, or if we're doing the state programs, like I said, we get everything turned in for you and go from there.
Is there, what I'm hearing then is that there's not ever a typical case?
No, absolutely not. No, it's different. And when I train navigators, it's, you can do the process, but every case is different. It literally, I mean, literally is. Every time they come in, it's someone different. And that's part of where we really enjoy covering kids and families, really enjoy doing that case management, that extra step in there, and really making sure that we're doing the best, what's best for the consumer, and learning about them, learning about their situation, their problems, their barriers.
We're taking questions from our audience members tonight. Jennifer, there's Jennifer.
Hi, I was in healthcare. I worked at Deaconess Health Plans for 6 years, and I recently ran for political office here. So I've been on both sides of the issue, politics and policy. And I want to know your thoughts on a bundled payment system as opposed to a fee-for-service, because I believe that that is the way we're going. You know, 19 years ago this week, actually, I had my daughter at Blanchfield Army Community Hospital. So people can't tell me that universal health care doesn't exist, because it exists on every military post in this country, and that it comes down basically to who provides the care and who pays for the care. I did not have mahogany beds that came out of the wall. You know, I didn't have a hotel stay. That's not what I was paying for. I was paying for, you know, health care, and I paid $46. I had a C-section, I had a three-day stay, and I paid $46. So it exists and it can happen. I just want to get your thoughts on bundled payments.
I support anything that moves us to value-based payments. So whether it's bundled payments or not, we need value-based payments in this country, and we will never fix the things that are wrong with healthcare and be able to emphasize what's right with healthcare until we do that, because whether it's bundled or whether it isn't bundled, quality matters and outcomes matter. And we do not focus enough on determinants of care. We do not focus enough currently on wellness initiatives, because there is no financial incentive for that the way healthcare is designed today. And we do not focus enough on quality and outcomes. And so that relationship between price and quality outcomes is where we need to go, bundled or not.
I would ask each of you, do you believe that healthcare is a basic human right?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. We have another question from a listener here about, again, about the single pay model. Mark, I think I might give this one to you. Sorry to give you all the single payer talk, but would increased taxes to fund a single pay model healthcare system be greater or less than the average yearly premium cost? There's a lot of people that say that we would take a big, big tax hit.
Right. Well, and yes, there wouldn't be a way to transform a system like that without a tax hit. I mean, that's a fact, is we'd need to find the mechanisms to fund something like that. Whether it be up more or less, you know, there's a lot of estimates all over the place, and I'm sure we've seen some of them as we hear some of the debates and everything else go on. But we really aren't good at anticipating that, so it's hard to get on that. If we look at the Affordable Care Act, for one example, it ended up being, for most people, a higher price tag than they were thinking, especially if you're not in that realm where you're getting your plan subsidized. It's more expensive. Why? Because we were optimistic. We thought more of those so-called young invincible folks would join on and bring the risk in the pool down. We didn't realize that maybe most of the people that needed coverage were the people that couldn't get it in the traditional market, that maybe had pre-existing conditions and other healthcare needs. So that came up much higher than anticipated. So it's difficult to be too optimistic, because we don't know until everybody has coverage what their use patterns could be like. And if that initial tax is X percent, is it going to go up the next year? Generally speaking, yeah, the bigger a pool gets for anything, the more predictable the pool is. But that would be a massive leap that we don't even have a baseline for, especially if we're still using that in the current U.S. healthcare delivery system, right? So Medicare for All is really talking more about a single-payer system, about the government's paying the bill on that, which we would raise the money through taxes, but it doesn't necessarily change the underlying system. The system might have to adapt to the rates and everything that go with that. So there's so many variables left to say. We saw the ACA rates climb up higher than expected. That could happen there too. Could it end up being less? That's also a possibility, but we're not good at estimating things that are this complex of the entire tax system of the United States, layered with the entire healthcare system of the United States. I say a very strong good luck on anybody that wants to take that estimate.
from where I sit, and I know that there's not just one variable, but from where I sit, it seems to me like the big reason that those costs kept climbing was exactly what you said, not enough healthy people buying plans. Would you say that's a fair...
That combined with just the political climate of people being unsure what was going to happen. Mm. So that also shook up a lot of the insurers to say, look, we've got to make sure we're going to be solvent at the end of this year and increase our rates in accordance to that. But yes, less healthy people signed up than thought, and more people that signed up were more unhealthy than we anticipated as well.
Mm.
The uninsured rates are astronomical. You know, that's one of the things that we at CKF look at and trying to target those, the people in the communities that are uninsured, to try to get them insured and reduce costs at the hospitals, reduce those bills that they're walking in to the emergency rooms and with no insurance, and just try to get that number lowered. So that, I think that's a big factor.
And we'll have more from last week's Issues and Ales event in Evansville, including questions from our live audience. Next, I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser, back now to Evansville and our live Issues and Ales event that took place last Thursday night, a discussion on healthcare.
We have another one here about inpatient services. When you're an inpatient with multiple services following you, it's impossible to keep track of which doctor is in network and which is not. And they go on to say, I think most people make sure the hospital is in network, but the consumer needs to know about the individual doctors, the lab, the pharmacy, the therapist. And they close in frustration. It's too much. Mark, have you heard this before?
Yes, this is probably one of the most regular things, and I'm sure a lot of listeners can relate of, I was going in for a procedure or just to get checked out. They send me down the hall, like literally physically down the hall,
same
to get a scan.
Building.
Same building. Suddenly I'm getting a bill for a $1,500 scan. What happened? And that's something very regularly we've heard. Now, I am happy to say this is something our Indiana State House is working on right now. They're not waiting for whatever's going to happen federally. So there's a good cluster of bills saying, if I'm in the building and I'm in network and I know it's in network, if I go down the hall, I shouldn't have to pay anything more than the same co-payments I would have paid for a network. And if that's going to vary, you need to give me notice of that. So I at least have the choice to make to say, gee, you mean I could go to the facility down the road instead of down the hall and save $1,000? I'll make that choice. As a matter of fact, they've also layered on top of that another piece of legislation that we're hoping will pass. If you go in for emergency care and where you go is out of network, or say if you're not actually conscious because it's an emergency and you get brought by ambulance to an out-of-network hospital, that would get treated like in-network care and you wouldn't get a surprise bill for that either. So two very good packages that we're working hard to cross our fingers on. And I definitely ask anybody listening to this to say, call your legislator and say, hey, these two things, let's do this, because that would stop a lot of the surprise billing problem that we're seeing.
We have one listener question about only being able to. I thought this was interesting. They said that we can only pick two of three things in a healthcare system. Low cost, high quality, universal coverage. So we can only have two of those three. We cannot have all three. And they go on to say that they would like to hear more about the trade-offs that exist among those three and how they could make decisions around those trade-offs. So let's just pick one, I guess. Low cost and universal coverage. Is it even possible?
Well, I think you've heard from some of the proposals that are out there, you know, somebody's got to pay for it. Hmm. So when you say low cost, that's relative.
So
right?
What we're sacrificing in this way is high quality.
We don't know that. There's not a design that we have to evaluate that talks about, and that's why we talked about this issue of value-based purchasing or value-based reimbursement or pricing or whatever. I mean, we really kind of know what quality is empirically inside of the health system because we have all of these benchmark standards that we want to follow for a host of things. You know, every single department has them, and those are things that drive improvements and high quality outcomes. But the other person that decides what a high quality outcome is the person we're serving. So that is the consumer. That's the patient. And that individual wants to know, was I okay with the price? Did I get educated? Did people have empathy for me while I was going through my really bad situation? I mean, there are qualitative as well as quantitative ways to determine what quality looks like inside of the healthcare system. So all of those things bundled together should have a relationship to price. And to me, until we get there, we're not going to have a satisfactory system for everybody. The other thing is you can't talk about value-based care without talking about wellness initiatives. And I mentioned that earlier. If you want to drive down the cost of healthcare, we need to deal with why people are sick, and we need to get people healthier. You know, one of the things that's an interesting indicator of wellness and longevity, good life expectancy, is that you graduated high school within 4 years of getting into the ninth grade. And believe it or not, we've seen our graduation rates starting to go up in this country across all groups. But we still have two racial groups that are in the 70%. And so, interestingly, those two groups also have high rates of chronic disease, diabetes, heart disease, and so on. So there are things that we can do. We're involved at Gibson General. We're very, very involved in these school programs where we have high school kids and other people come in. They do things with us. We try to help educate them and so forth. But there are a lot of things that go into that equation about the relationship between quality and price. But we can never get away from needing to elevate the health status in our society.
Amber, are you ever surprised at how little people know when you deal with them and you're helping people?
Absolutely. That is one of the biggest barriers, I think, that people have. They just, they're uneducated about it. They're unaware of programs. They don't know how to go about seeing if they qualify. They don't know how to go about the application process itself. And like Claudia was saying, once they do get insured, they're more apt to do the wellness screenings. They're more apt to do the vaccinations. They're more apt to have the kids, you know, in there for their physicals. And that relationship needs to be made. And it's obvious those that have the insurance will do those things.
Mark, we talked a little bit about bills moving through. Do we have any idea how well they're doing, whether or not things are going to move and in what direction?
You know, I can say I think we're in pretty good shape. The big driver this year was really looking at healthcare costs was something that was on the governor's agenda. And that's usually seen as the blueprint for, hey, legislators, this is what I need you to do this year. The only things that were elevated at the same tier were smoking and vaping, which obviously relates to some of our discussion today,
right?
And enforcing some of that. If the listeners didn't know, you know, we actually have raised the smoking age and put some barriers on attaining vaping products as well. But we need to pass laws at the state level so we can actually have enforcement behind that and penalize the people that are selling to our youth and things like that. So between that and education, the only other thing that was really on that list was healthcare costs. So we started this year with probably more bills than I could have reasonably tracked, about 30 in that space. And they tend to morph and combine and work themselves out during session. I've still got a solid dozen bills on the list that are all about, in one way or another, controlling healthcare cost. Now, interestingly, when I don't see enough on there is the topic that we were just talking about with personal responsibility and what the term is social determinants of health. If I have good housing, I'm going to be more apt to be healthy. If I have links to a good job, if I'm getting my GED or if I'm getting pathways to college and other things, all those things link together further into my healthy behaviors and my ability to be healthy. Sometimes we forget that we like to say personal responsibility, but you have to be at a certain point of privilege in your life before you can worry about your health. If you're worried about surviving and having enough to get through the day, health for tomorrow is a luxury item. Preventative activities, going out for a half-hour jog every morning when you're worried about how you're going to get the kids to school this day or get yourself to work, right? We've got to address those other items. And sometimes we miss that because personal responsibility is a great thing to say, and you bet there's plenty of places where we could all do better on that. I've got a list of my own. But we need to help people on the path to personal responsibility and remove some barriers that just make that, again, something that's for other people, that's in the future, that's not for today. And we've got a lot of Hoosiers figuring out how to live through today, and we're asking them all to look 5 years into the future for their health. And that's not a fair burden to put on anybody.
Amber, how often do you have to fix people's insurance? Like, they come to you and they're under, and there's a lot of undercoverage. There are a lot of people who signed up for, I can't even remember what they're called.
The short-term plans.
Yeah, and with the super high deductibles and things like that.
Yeah, I'm going to defer to Mark on those short-term plans. He loves talking about those.
Those are messy, Mark.
Right, and there's a lot of, and to bundle them, we call them non-ACA compliant plans. They're not part of the Affordable Care Act. Actually, by state law, a lot of times you can't call them insurance. They're not regulated as an insurance product. And these were brought out largely in response to people saying, well, it's just too expensive. What are some other options? They'd come out with plans that sounded good, $50 a month, $100 a month, but a lot of times have very, very high deductibles. We're talking $10,000. Being good in those cases, some as high as $20,000 or more that you have to pay before it pays anything. And they're really marketed as catastrophic plans. So the one things that they cover are usually some hospital level things. But if it doesn't kick in until $15,000, and then it covers those things, but it covers them only at a 60-40 rate. So you're still paying 40% of that on top of that. Probably not a good option for a whole bunch of people, even if they think they're getting it just for a catastrophic case. Mm. And the tough thing is, if you get one of those plans, you're not necessarily going to, say, if you try it for a few months and you realize, wait, this doesn't cover anything. This doesn't cover my doctor's visits, mental health care, maternity care is generally not covered on these either. You could be in some trouble where you might have to wait an entire another year to be able to get on the marketplace or something similar. Because it doesn't actually legally count as insurance, dropping it doesn't count as losing insurance. And losing insurance opens up a special enrollment period. So anybody that can follow that, right? But again, the consumer that hears that and hears the too good be true, or gets that voice message or one of the 3,000 robocalls we're getting a day these days and goes for that, they don't realize all those downroad implications that they could have until they have it. And then we really hope they don't have a major healthcare need in the middle of that. And I don't blame the consumer for that. I get it. You know, we're in a world where we're all trying to save things. If somebody calls and says, this will cover everything you need, and it's not somebody like going through a Navigator program, like Covering Kids and Families, that's saying, let's find out what you need, and I'll tell you which products might be some of the best for you. Mm. It's a salesperson, and that's way different than somebody who's coming in unbiased and trying to find the right thing for you. But that consumer could be left in a very bad situation for the remainder of that coverage year.
Okay. So we're going to open it up to questions from anyone in the audience, if you might have one, for our panel. Over here in the red hat.
I've noticed when my wife had a procedure, and the insurance refused to pay, I get a bill for $48. No big deal. But when I appealed to the insurance and the insurance company paid, well, suddenly the clinic's willing to accept $13. What's the justification for the insurance company getting a 75% discount on medical procedures?
The insurance companies contract with various providers, and based on those contracted rates, because they're contracting for volume, they get fairly deep discounts oftentimes. And that is why a lot of these conversations should take the patient out and the insurer and and the healthcare provider need to be talking through what's going on, because there's a contract that's in place for certain things that was pre-negotiated before you and your wife ever entered in to the doors of that establishment, whether that was a hospital or a clinic or whatever. Most people don't realize if you're paying for something, if you walk into a hospital and say, listen, I want to pay for this myself because maybe you have a high deductible plan or whatever, you can negotiate a rate with the insurance companies or with the hospital or the clinic.
Anybody else?
Hello, my name is Dustin. Earlier you mentioned a marketplace price where it sounded like if a provider exceeds the price set, they'd be held, it sounded like, against violating the law. So my question was, who decides these marketplace prices?
There are what we were talking about is employing doctors specifically. So there are a number of national databases that essentially have compensation information by region around the country. And the federal government has made very clear through some laws that they have that said you cannot pay more than fair market value in any specialty in your area of the country. So we have to be able to prove and support what fair market value is. So there are a couple of different ways to do that. There is one database that's put out by a group called MGMA. So you have to buy the database, and then annually it is updated. There's also several other databases, and you can take a cross-section of those databases and compare the compensation in those based in your area, and you have to pay within those fair market value standards. It is absolutely against the law to pay outside of those fair market value standards.
All right, we have time for one more if anyone has it.
You focus largely on these so-called surprise bills, and I would submit that these aren't truly surprises. They are crafted by the work of the insurers and the providers working together to create a system that creates these gaps that leaves patients in the hole. But beyond these so-called surprise bills, there are a lot of other so-called covered items for which patients can face horrifically expensive copays, spend downs, and the infamous donut hole. And among these are insulin, maintenance inhalers for asthma and COPD, and of course, as our beloved pharma bro would remind us, of the EpiPen. What's being done on this front to control so-called non-surprise bills?
And I could talk a little bit about that, at least what we have going on at the State House, because in a lot of that I hear you talking about is the pharmaceutical costs are a big one of that, so I'll go with that example. There are a few bills working on that. There's one that actually just got sent on its way to the governor's desk today. Indiana was the only state in the country that you had to have a prescription to buy emergency insulin. So if you were diabetic and insulin dependent, it's Friday, you're out of dose, you would have to literally go to a hospital and pay a very large cost to get dosed over the weekend for that. Or you could go, like every other state in the country, and pay about $30 at your local pharmacy to get enough to get you through the weekend. And most diabetics know very well how to dose themselves and watch their dosing, right? So that's actually something that is going through. We have a couple of pharmacists at the State House that are actually working extremely hard on that. I'll say that's Senator Grooms and Representative Davison are great people to reach out to if you want to talk about donut holes and prescription pricing. Insulin's the big one right now because we've seen prices skyrocket so much, but it's in other places too. And they're working on packages in a couple of different areas about how do we say that there shouldn't be a necessary prescription for you that costs 10 times as much as anything else out there. Why isn't that standard? That your copayment is your copayment, and there shouldn't be suddenly a cost of $400 to have something life-saving such as insulin.
I want to thank all of our panelists. Amber Williams, lead healthcare navigator at Covering Kids and Families of TRICAP. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And Mark Fairchild, policy director at Covering Kids and Families. Thanks, Mark.
Glad to be here.
Claudia Eisenman, President and CEO of Gibson General Hospital. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for being here. Thanks to the listeners of WNIN. Thanks to you for being here. And we hope that we can do this again here at Damsel. Thanks, everybody.
And if you would like to participate in discussions like this, join our Indiana 2020 two-way texting group by texting elections to 73224. Plenty more to talk about, and we look forward to our next live event. On-site technical help for this episode came from Steve Jensen and Tim Rohrman, and a big thanks to Indiana Public Broadcasting superstar Robin Rockle, who organized this whole thing. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.